Welcome to Two-Way Street. Today we're going to talk about something that's completely free of charge, but that many, many people might call the most valuable commodity in the world, sleep. It's supposed to be restful and restorative. So why does it produce such anxiety? How many of you in here worry that you're not getting enough sleep every night?
Me.
How many of you in here have had what you consider to be significant bouts of insomnia?
Me.
How many of you feel anxious about sleep when you go to bed every night?
Me.
Those are the voices of the audience that came to the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library last week to watch us record a conversation with our guest, Benjamin Rees. He's the author of Wild Nights: How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. You might expect a book that explores our troubles with sleep to come from a doctor or a scientist, but Rees is a professor of English at Emory University. Nevertheless, he found himself confronting a question he really wanted to answer. Why do so many of us feel that despite all our efforts to tame our sleep, it's fundamentally beyond our control? Rees drew upon his deep knowledge of literature to explore how we've viewed sleep through the ages and how the rules we've created around sleep may be making it harder for us to get a good night's rest. Ben, I think you make the point very early in your book, and the audience confirms it. You say this: when it comes to sleep, we seem to have this sense we are doing something wrong. And you point out that in 2009, 20% of the people who responded to a poll said they slept less than 6 hours a night. A decade earlier, it was only 10% of those people. So we clearly struggle with the whole concept of sleep.
Yeah, we do. I don't want to be saying, though, that people today sleep less than they did in the past. And the first thing I want to say is that we have certain advantages as contemporary sleepers that very few people in other times and places have had. We have more comfortable and hygienic sleeping arrangements for a wider number of people probably than ever before in history. We know more about sleep. The advances in sleep science are really profound. And we have all kinds of apparatus that help us sleep better, pills, products that we can buy, comfortable bedding, and so on. But it begs the question why so many people feel that they're doing it wrong, that it just doesn't fit, and they struggle with it, and they experience anxiety around it. And I think a big part of the answer, I'm not a physician, I'm not a scientist, the answer has to do more with the kinds of expectations that we as a society bring to sleep, which are actually very narrow and rigid expectations, and they often don't fit with the kinds of waking lives that people lead.
Yeah, we should point out at the very beginning that this is not a prescriptive book. You have not joined the vast army of people out there who have written books about, had sleep aid. I mean, you talk about, you quantify to some extent how much is out there in the world of sleep aids and books about sleep, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, every year there are dozens of self-help books, training systems for how to get children to sleep. Think about how weird that is. This activity that every creature undergoes, you know, and is a requirement for life. It's free, it doesn't cost any money, right? It's there for us, it's a resource that's available to us and that we all need. And we've gone through however many millennia of history. And in the last 100 years or so, it's become an activity that we need to train people to do. And we have these rules and charts and diagrams about how much is the appropriate amount of sleep, what's the best way to get a child, how long should you let a child cry before you go in and soothe the child, and all this kind of thing. And people, you know, and then competing systems about how to do it. We've made this kind of mess out of this very basic, not just human activity, but animal activity.
Yeah, and so when I say your book is not prescriptive, right. It does not offer solutions for us. Rather, you've taken a look at the history and the sociology that surrounds how we've approached sleep for thousands of years.
Right, yeah. And
how that's had an impact on how we sleep. right? Is that a fair way to characterize
it? So, yes, and I think because what I said at the beginning, that we know more about sleep and we have all these advantages as contemporary sleepers, clearly the problem is not, the social problem is not, it's not a biological problem. It's not something about a problem in our bodies that needs to be fixed and tinkered with. That sense that we have to fix it and tinker it and micromanage it and put it in a box itself creates, adds to the stress around sleep. The problem, I think, has to do more with our moment in history and how we're conditioned to think about sleep and to try to make it work for other ends.
Okay, I want to talk with you. You describe in the book, throughout the book, and we'll go over them a little more slowly, but in a moment I'd like to talk about what you call the rules of sleep. But before I do, have you been a troubled sleeper? What brought you to this book?
I've had intermittent insomnia, and I went through a particularly severe bout when I was in graduate school. It lasted a couple of months where I was only getting a couple of hours of sleep a night, and it deranged me. And it's a very real problem. And insomnia has been a problem that people have dealt with for as long as there have been humans. I don't want to say that all of the sleep problems that we have are contemporary troubles. People have been tinkering with it using opium or other kinds of exotic remedies for millennia. But yeah, I went through my own struggles with it, and I think that did give.
Are you still an anxious sleeper? Do you wake up saying, "I went to sleep at 11. What time is it now? Did I get enough sleep?"
No, I don't do that.
Okay.
And I try to give myself more leeway to be a flexible sleeper.
The rules of sleep, and these, by the way, are not positive rules that we should emulate. Let's just go over them, okay?
Sure.
Because you talk about them early on. And you basically started with the first one that you mentioned in the book. Sleep through the night in one straight shot for about 7 or 8 hours. You, as you've already said, that isn't necessarily, this is how we're taught now to deal with sleep, but it isn't necessarily in our best interests.
Well, it may be in the best interest for some,
right.
It may not work for others. And many cultures have very different ideas, napping cultures, et cetera, that are quite different from this.
Form a habit of preparing for sleep at roughly the same time every night, no matter what season, preceded by similar pre-bed rituals. Well, I buy that. I mean, if I'm not in bed by 9:30, well, I'm old. it throws me off completely, but that's not necessarily the right way to approach
it. Well, if you think about it, think about people living in very different circumstances from yours. And so, for instance, in an Inuit community in Saskatchewan, where they're, the seasons, the availability of light, it varies greatly from season to season, and also the availability of food. If you have to stay up to great hours in the summer seasons hunting caribou and storing up enough protein for the winter, you're not going to go to bed early, right? And then in the wintertime, when there isn't as much food and you want to conserve energy and heat, it's going to make more sense to stay in bed. So there's a great seasonal variability in sleeping in many cultures. And in ours, if you spend all day in bed in the winter, they say you have seasonal affective disorder, right? It would be a threat to your survival in some situations to put yourself on that kind of strict pattern.
Is this a good time to talk about Henry David Thoreau, with that notion in mind, following the natural cycles rather than some prescribed notion of waking and sleeping? Because you bring Thoreau in, you thread him through a good portion of the book, and say that Walden, you found many clues in there for how perhaps clues we might want to think about in terms of how we sleep.
Yeah, you know, I was teaching a course, a survey of American literature, around the time I was putting together this course on sleep with the neurologist. And I had read Walden about a half a dozen times before, taught it in classes. And I read it in this context and realized, oh my God, the whole thing's about sleep and waking. And and it turns out he really went through this horrible period of insomnia and disturbed sleep in the period leading up to going off to his experiment in life in the woods. And one of the things that was really remarkable about it was thinking about it through the lens of sleep. It felt like a very contemporary book. And when he talks about taking walks into the village and looking at how the villagers lead their lives, It's a kind of new factory town, Concord, Massachusetts, in the 1840s. The railroad tracks have just gone on. People are constantly guzzling coffee, freaking out about getting themselves on schedule so they can show up at the factory on time, trying to catch the train on time. And there was even a moment in the book where he says he knew of a man who could barely take a nap for a half hour without waking up and demanding to hear what the news was. And it felt like, you know, somebody reaching for their smartphone in the middle of the night. So it seemed very contemporary. And I trace back a lot of the disturbances that we've been associating with sleep back to the period that Thoreau lived through. I call him my lead witness.
You say one aspect of the natural world from which Thoreau felt most alienated was his own body, which had fallen out of sync with the great pulsing rhythms he heard and saw all around him at the pond. Recovering his balance and his rest on his own time to the beat of his own drummer was the subtext of his experiment in the woods.
Yeah, you know, Thoreau was a great naturalist. And one of the things that he was really fascinated by was the effects of time on living things. And so he kept these meticulous records of when trees would leaf out every spring, and when flowers would open, and when the hibernating creatures would come out of their holes. And many of these records have actually been of use to scientists in contemporary studies today. But one of the things that he began to track was his own body and how it responded to his natural environment. And Walden is really a great record of his attempts to sort of unstick himself from the sense of time that he felt was imprisoning other people.
And you assume he slept better once he had unstuck himself?
He didn't complain much about it. He complained a lot about it before, but he talks a lot about, you know, taking these rapturous walks by moonlight. He may have been an owl, or he may have gotten up in the middle of the night to...
Yeah, because we do know that he took nighttime strolls.
Oh, yeah.
That was part of his life at Walden Pond.
Yeah, and these are some of the most beautiful passages in the book. But you couldn't do that if you were sleeping on the schedule.
This notion of sleeping for a while, getting up, going back to sleep, finding a more natural rhythm for sleep, you point out to us that the Industrial Revolution had a significant impact on trying to do that. It really, there are very few of us today, whether we're working in a factory, at a university, in an office, who have the luxury of sleeping according to our natural rhythms, right?
Right. Yeah, and you know, that set of forces that we call the Industrial Revolution did to sleep rhythms was, in the most basic sense, it got people on a schedule that didn't have anything to do with season or time of day, right? You show up at the factory floor at 8 a.m., whether it's January or whether it's April. And so much has to follow from that. And because an industrial society had to be, all the different parts had to be in sync with each other, school times had to follow suit. And because when people were working in factories, they, you know, in previous generations, most families had done their work in the home. Suddenly getting everybody's schedule synchronized, so they had to be in different places, you know, at different times on a schedule, really disturbed people's rhythms in pretty fundamental
ways.
Okay,
but you do say your book's not prescriptive. On the other hand, you have a chapter in the book called Utopian Sleep, and one of the things you write about in there is the possibility that we might work in a workplace where we're allowed nap time.
Yeah, I don't think that's
Doesn't
utopian.
Doesn't that sound great?
I don't necessarily think that's utopian. I think there are such places.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I think there are plenty of such places, particularly in Silicon Valley. They're all about napping, and that's often a way to get workers to spend longer hours in the office, right, and to be more productive.
Oh, okay, sorry. My
vision about sleep, in a way, if I have one, is that we try to unhook it from these economic forces that are shaping it. When we worry about sleep, I think we're usually worrying about something else. We're worried about productivity, we're worried about our efficiency, we're worrying about the risks of, you know, operating machinery or driving a car or something like that. And if we can figure out what those forces are that are kind of conditioning our sleep, I think that might be an approach that would help people figure out what the trouble is, more than what pill do I take or what Yeah. What manual do I read?
Let's look at another one of those rules that you say we've come to accept for our sleep. Do it alone or with at most one other consenting partner. Now, here's what's funny about that. I'd read your book, and yesterday my Wall Street Journal app popped up with a feature story about the new trend for people with money was twin master bedrooms.
Yes.
So that's right in line.
Well,
so with that in mind,
okay, let's talk about the twin master bedrooms first, because there is one very strange thing about the way we are told to sleep, and that is that children are trained to sleep alone, and
right.
We spend an enormous amount of energy and money, and there's often a lot of stress and strain involved with getting children to sleep on their own. My wife is smiling at the moment. And we insist upon it, right, from as early as 6 months. Get the child to go off into this solitary space and stay there all night. Don't bother mommy and daddy. There's a lot of kind of morality around that, as well as ideas about child development and so on. But then we expect them, when they grow up, to share a bed with somebody. And to work it out. I mean, well, if you've been trained to think of doing sleep in your own private fortress, how are you going to deal with somebody else who's snoring or checking their phone or taking a trip to the bathroom or whatever? So that leads to this development, I think, about married couples now wanting separate master bedrooms. But the part about at most two consenting adults sharing bed space, through a lot of human history, it was common for much larger groups of people to share surfaces together.
Tell you what.
What's that?
I think that's a really interesting part of your book. We need to take a quick break.
Okay.
Let's talk a little more about that when we come back, okay?
Sounds good.
You're listening to Two-Way Street. My guest is Benjamin Rees. His book is Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. If you're just joining us, my guest is Benjamin Rees, Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. Ben, before we took the break, started talking about how people didn't necessarily sleep alone or with one partner. And I was really fascinated. You tell the story of an anthropologist named Roger Lohman who went to New Guinea and spent some time with a tribe called the
Asabanos. Yeah.
Tell the story about what the chief told him the first night he was there.
Yeah, so he was there, and the chief came up to him and sort of apologized that he couldn't sleep with him. And and Lohman said, well, that's okay. And he said, no, really. We have this festival or something like this, and I can't. But I assure you, you will be properly attended to in the future. And he realized that in this society, that sleeping alone was considered to be, you know, a form of being outcast.
It was a sociable activity.
Yeah, sleep was a sociable activity, and there were protections that came with sleeping in a group, and it sort of makes sense if you think about the dangers that are associated with sleep for people to sleep much closer together, in groups, and when we talk about people not just having one standard time frame for sleeping, if you have a mixture of people with different kinds of sleep patterns, some who get up in the middle of the night or some who naturally stay up a little bit later. It forms a kind of protective, ring around the sleeper that somebody will always be up to watch.
Yeah, there's a sense of security to that you're suggesting. So let's talk more about that, though, because you, again, weaving literature into the book, you talk about that great first chapter of Moby Dick when Ishmael comes to, is it New Bedford, the town, and he goes to the inn and he meets for the first time as he's in bed Queequeg, the great, great whale.
Spear thrower. Yeah. So he goes to an inn, you know, as he's preparing to board the whale ship, and the innkeeper says, "Oh, you sleep in there with that guy, Queequeg, who's got tattoos all over him, and he carries a shrunken human head, and he's got his harpoon and a hatchet with him, most fierce looking person he's ever met." And Ishmael says, "Well, you know." "Do I have to?" He said, "Well, if you want to sleep, that's where you're sleeping." And he says, "You know, no man wants to share a bed with another person, but I had to do it." And before long, they're snuggling up together. They're chatting peaceably through the night. They're sharing a pipe, telling stories, and he says at the end of it, "I never slept better in my life." And the thing that was strange about that story, well, there's plenty that's strange about it, but it's a beautiful relationship that forms between these two. But one of the things that's strange about it historically is that he had an aversion to doing this, because up until the 19th century, that was completely common for people to share beds with strangers as they were traveling, even people, relatively wealthy people.
Yeah, well, for instance, there are lots of stories, although it's not in your book. Abraham Lincoln, when he was out on the circuit in Illinois as a young lawyer, shared a bed often with his law partner, with others. And what's odd about that is that there have been historians who have tried to use that to suggest that perhaps Lincoln had some homosexual tendencies, which it's an interesting... It's interesting that we would put that spin on it, or some people would, when in fact it was fairly common.
Well, Moby Dick kind of invites it a little bit because Ishmael and Queequeg start referring to the hatchet as their baby, and they talk about being a cozy, loving couple and so on. So we can go there.
Oh, but, okay. you tell us it's Samuel Pepys.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So the great diarist. Wrote about sharing. He would rank his bedmates as he traveled according to who was the best conversationalist.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
And nothing about, "Oh, I had to share a bed." Was just, which ones do I prefer?
What ended social sleeping?
Well, I think starting in about the 17th century, maybe even a little before that, there were always concerns about the health consequences of sharing bedding with other people and breathing each other's air. Most contagion was understood to be airborne through pretty far into the 19th century. And when you get into the 19th century and you have this development of factory towns and workers flocking into the city, they're sharing lodgings with large numbers of other workers and sometimes multiple families sharing a room. And disease really did spread. There were a lot of health reform efforts to try to stamp it out and to insist on privacy as a basic right for workers. Okay. But there was another factor too, as there was this increasing emphasis on privacy for Europeans and white North Americans. Missionaries and colonialists who were exploring other parts of the world were basically exploring these co-sleeping cultures. And they came to define their own, what they perceived as their own superiority in relation to these other cultures, and saying, you know, sleeping in groups, that's for savages. And there was one of the best known sleep hygiene books of the 19th century talked about co-sleeping societies and said they're like vermin or hogs that sleep together. And every basically proper white person is going to demand their own room. And so we have to insist on this for our children.
It's much more acceptable for young children to sleep with their parents, right?
Yeah, that's right. And if you think about it, the spatial requirements for solitary sleep for childhood just aren't available to most people in the world and haven't been through history. I mean, even in Europe up through the middle of the 19th century, very few families could afford the space to spread out in the way that's required, especially when family sizes were so much larger then. So even if the children weren't sleeping in bed with the parents or in the room with the parents, they would often double up, th- Thoreau did with his brother, John. They shared a trundle bed all through their adolescence. And most families just couldn't afford it. Industrialization also brought with it some riches, and that spread through the middle class very unevenly, and it allowed for homes to expand in this way. So the question is, why did people want to do this? Especially since almost nobody had ever demanded this of children before. I think one really big factor was the introduction of electricity and electric lighting into homes. That suddenly parents had impetus to stay up later, right? And to do things in their leisure time at night that the children weren't involved with. So whether it was reading or entertaining guests or later listening to the radio or watching television, suddenly you wanted to parcel people out.
Yeah. You tell a story. You know, I always think of Benjamin Spock, the baby doctor, as kind of this great, kind soul in terms of how he taught parents to deal with their children. But you tell us that Benjamin Spock was so deeply believed in children sleeping on their own that he suggested that parents do what with their children?
Well, he said if you have a little one who crawls out of the crib, and might come into the parent's bedroom, you must not allow this to happen because the child might witness the parents doing something that would be traumatic. Spock was a Freudian, right? And so seeing the parents engaged in amatory activity at night was, you know, something deeply worrying or traumatic. And so he said, what I recommend is that you take a badminton net and string it across the top of the crib to kind of trap the child in the crib. And he was this great gentle soul who famous for being lenient and so on, but he was so fixated on this idea.
You know, one of the things about that section of your book that really, really resonated for me, and I'll bet you it's true of many people who are here tonight, is some of our worst memories of sleep going way, way back have to do with just that, being little children forced to be alone in a bedroom, being afraid of the dark, longing for our parents to be there. That's a powerful, powerful feeling to carry with you. And no wonder that to some extent it could affect people as adults in the way they approach sleep.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I think if you compare it to an earlier bit of advice about sleep that comes from Rousseau, he said the only habit we should allow children to get into with their sleep is the habit of having no habits. And sleep, children's sleep is something that has become so fussed over and worried over that I think a lot of children start to associate it with stress. You know, here's this grown-up telling me to sleep when I don't want to and to go off into that dark room and stay there all night when I'd rather be with them, or you know, I want to be up doing something else. And it becomes this kind of zone of conflict. And we have a whole genre of books that exists, well, two genres of books, one that trains parents how to do it correctly, and the other that is meant to ease the child's passage into the solitary room, and that's the bedtime storybook.
Yeah.
And so many of these books end with, you know, the little bunny going off to bed or the little animal going back to the zoo.
I never fell for that.
Right. Yeah, a few do. But the subtext of most of them is, okay, night time, now time to go up there.
Good night moon. One of the
exactly.
Great examples of just
right.
That.
Yeah. You know, you say goodnight to the little old lady and the great green room and off you go. Bye-bye. It's very peaceful and soothing, but it's also coercive.
Yeah. I love the way you work literature into the book. We've talked about a couple of examples. You tell us about, you use Lady Macbeth to describe the fact that in the past, you say, we tried to tame sleep medically rather than let it run its wild and mysterious course. And you point out that in Macbeth, the doctor who sees Lady Macbeth sleepwalking says, more needs she the divine than the physician.
That's right. So a doctor is consulted because she has this terrifying condition where she's sleepwalking and saying these strange foreboding things. And the doctor comes in and says, well, you know, nothing I can do about it. This is a spiritual problem. And I think one of the things that has really changed about sleep over time is that it's increasingly become medicalized. And when we have trouble with it, we consult a physician, we want a pill, we want expert advice. But part of what's been lost is that spiritual dimension, the mystery of it, the sense that it might be a portal to some other world that's been so powerful in literature and religious traditions for a long time.
Aristotle plays a role in your book. He wrote on sleeping and waking, and I think it was in that treatise that he said, or he suggested that sleep was a matter of digestion, which was a fairly commonly held belief in early times.
Yeah, and he's not wrong. Sleep is involved in a lot of different physiological processes, and the idea was that while you digested, basically the food was being burned up and hot vapors rose into your brain that made you drowsy. And that's not, neurologists and neuroscientists, I think, wouldn't quite accept that as an explanation. But sleep and all kinds of different bodily processes are involved, digested including.
All right, there's something I really want to make sure we have time to talk about, and then we're going to take a break and then open the floor to questions. But there's a very important part of your book that we really have to address. You talk about the populations of people whose circumstances don't allow them the luxury of sleeping well. You talk about slaves. You talk about people living in poverty. You talk about how hunger, war, illness play a role in people having disruptive sleep. And you quote Thomas Jefferson, who believed that he didn't have to give his slaves as much time to sleep as white people around them because black people didn't need as much sleep as white people. So talk a little bit about this whole notion of the luxury of sleep that some populations simply don't have.
Yeah, well, you know, when I talk about the rules of sleep that you outlined, right, these are things that many people in a comfortable socioeconomic status will wrestle with, and it becomes a psychological burden to try to adjust your sleep to those expectations, right? But those are rules that simply can't be adhered to by many people the world over and if you think about poor people today, I mean, to be poor is to be badly rested. The idea of an 8-hour sleep cycle and an 8-hour unbroken stretch for sleep is just impossible for somebody who's holding down jobs at odd hours, multiple part-time jobs, in an environment that might be unsafe or noisy. The idea of separating children from parents at night and everybody having their own space, it requires means to be able to do that. And so a lot of these rules don't apply, as many of us who do feel comfortable in our beds at night still wrestle with these rules. Sleep is a far worse ordeal for many people. And
when you said people who are poor are unrested, that's a kind of a stunning statement. I mean, among all the other things we think about what people living in poverty deal with, the notion that it disrupts your ability to sleep well is really troubling.
Yeah, and then it has cascading effects because you don't sleep well. There are health effects that are associated with that. Increased risk for diabetes, in part because when you're tired, you tend to eat more and eat worse. Your cognitive abilities decline. You're at risk for accidents. Your immune system is weakened if you're not sleeping well, so there are health effects. But then if you think about somebody who's poor and has a job interview or something like that to try to move out of poverty, when you're not rested, your performance suffers. And so it has ripple effects.
We're going to take another break. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Ben Reese. This is Two-Way Street. We're talking today on Two-Way Street with Ben Reese. He's the author of Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World. And we're recording our conversation with Ben in front of a live audience at the Jimmy Carter Presidential Library, which we love to do on occasion on Two-Way Street. And thank you all for being here tonight. It's great to have you in the audience for this great conversation with Ben. We're going to take some audience questions. We got microphones that you're also, some of you are already lined up for. Tell us your name and then ask your question.
My name is Anthony Wallen. And first I have to say, my three kids are now going to sleep with me tonight, and my wife,
so they know
they're loved.
You have my permission.
One thing I noticed back when Hurricane Wilma came, which was right after Katrina, we were without power down in Florida for 9 days, and the best sleep I had in my life.
Wow.
Because there was no electricity. The light went out. You couldn't read a book. You couldn't plug in your phone. There was nothing to do except go to sleep. And it was great. And my question is, how much has electricity damaged sleep for modern society?
Great question, because you deal with it in the book.
Yeah, well, electricity brings with it a whole host of distractions and devices that can really affect sleep. And there's been a lot of research in recent years about the effects of screen use on sleep. And they're twofold. One is that you can always entertain yourself with the screen. There's no shut-off time. TVs used to go off at, 12 at night or whatever. We'd have a test pattern come on, and then it was done. Well, now it's 24/7, right? But it's not just the distraction and the possibility of doing things to keep yourself awake, but the light itself, the kind of light, blue light, it actually suppresses melatonin, which is the hormone that primarily regulates sleep and waking. And so it tricks your brain into thinking that it's still day. So even after you shut off the screen, you have a carryover effect where it's really hard to shut down. And so it's had a huge effect. But going back even to earlier periods, the invention of the electric light bulb, meant so much to, workplaces could be lit up at night so people would work later. Families could entertain themselves in their parlors. In ways that just weren't possible previously. And I do want to say, since we're at the Carter Center, that I had an opportunity to talk with President Carter. He's a faculty member here at Emory, and he gets together with small groups of faculty members once or twice a semester and asks them about their work. And I asked him about his sleep and how it had changed over time. And he said, when I was growing up, we went to bed when the sun went down. We didn't have electricity, but everything changed when we got not the light bulb, but my first radio. And I would stay up late to listen to the Glenn Miller orchestra at 9 o'clock at night in the middle of winter, And so it really changed his life too.
Terrific, thank you for that. Yes, sir, thank you. Last question.
Hi, Deborah Reed. I speak about sleep all day long in my profession. I'm in healthcare. I have been for about 40 years now. And so sleep and mental health issues go hand in hand. But I want to ask about something else. You spoke about industrialization, and I've seen this being in the healthcare sector a lot. The 24/7 culture has driven people to sleep at other times of the day, and here we are in our Western sleep mode. And the long-term consequences of working 30 years with the police department, on night shift, it really is difficult to be undone, if not impossible. Have you seen anything about that sprouting up?
Yeah, well, so one thing I want to say about it is that one sort of counter effect of industrialization was that certain groups of workers started agitating for the right to rest. And, the labor cry in the early 20th century of 8 hours for work, 8 hours for sleep, 8 hours for rest, 8 hours for what you will, it played some role in standardizing that eight-hour model, but it also said, this is a basic human right. And in our society, we do have, in many industries, we have protections around sleep deprivation in certain areas. Truck drivers are only allowed to drive so many hours before they have to take a rest. But in a lot of parts of the world, they don't. And these tend to be parts of the world where we outsource labor. And so in a lot of the places where our technological gadgets are made, they're made by people who are working 60, 70 hours a week in conditions that were very much like 19th century American or British factory floors.
Ben Reese, in the epilogue to your book, Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World, you say this: something about becoming the sleep guy seems to have made me a magnet for interesting divulgences and unusual conversations. And in hearing...
I think we've seen that, yes.
We've seen that here with our audience. But also, in just hearing you talk about sleep and all that you've learned as you've researched how our society over eons has dealt with sleep, it's no wonder that people are so fascinated with this. We're all interested in this subject, and you've written about it in such a compelling way, and we all got a chance to hear for about an hour tonight just how interesting this subject really is. So thank you so much for being here for Two Way Street.
Thanks very much.
And to our audience at the Carter Library, thank you for being with us. It was a joy to have you all here. You can learn more about Ben Reese's book, Wild Nights, How Taming Sleep Created Our Restless World, by coming to our website at gpb.org/TWS. We'll also have the information posted on our Facebook page. And while you're there, like us. When did you know poetry was going to be your medium?
I mean, I think other people I didn't. Other people around me would say they knew before I knew. I think sometime in college I realized that the poems I was writing weren't as terrible as I felt they were.
That's poet Kevin Young, who we featured on Two Way Street almost a year ago. At the time, he was teaching at Emory University, even as his work was winning more and more acclaim in literary circles. Kevin joined us to discuss his most recent book at the time, Blue Laws, Selected and Uncollected Poems. At year's end, it was longlisted for a National Book Award. In the months since we talked to Kevin, a lot of good things have happened to him. Late last year, he left Atlanta to become the director of the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, which is a division of the New York Public Library. But just last week, Kevin was named the new poetry editor of The New Yorker. The magazine has an almost 100-year history of publishing the finest poets of their times. Kevin told the Boston Globe recently that he first discovered The New Yorker's poetry tradition when, as a high school student, he read The New Yorker Book of Poems. He's had his work published in The New Yorker since 1999. When I heard Kevin's good news, I went back to listen again to the conversation we had with him last year. For me, one of the most illuminating things he talked about was the remarkable history of an early American poet, Phyllis Wheatley.
She was the first poet, African poet, published in America. You know, she was stolen when she was probably 9 or so, they don't know. And she was sold to a family in Boston and renamed after the slave ship that took her, which is just haunting to be named Phyllis because of that. And, you know, she wrote one book. She actually probably wrote another book. We know that this book existed. She advertised for it. There are poems from it, but people think that the manuscript was maybe taken from her, perhaps even by her sort of husband who wasn't so great, and it may be broken up in pieces. More importantly to me, she wrote her way sort of out of slavery. Certainly she wrote her way to travel to London to get to seek donors to get this book published. And I think getting that book published in 1773 is such a landmark. She had a book tour. You know, I've seen others sign books. She signed her book. She was an author. You know, it wasn't simply she wrote some poems and someone else gathered them. She really thought about it. And those poems I tried to understand as a way of talking back to tradition.
It's astonishing to think that a woman who was brought to this country as a slave ended up, as you say, buying her way out of slavery, was acknowledged as an artist in her time, published a book, and became a free woman because of it.
Well, and you know, I don't want to overstate. She actually didn't, you know, her mistress, as it were, still kept her a slave, even though they
did.
She went to Europe and then was called back because her mistress had taken sick. And we can only imagine the freedom she felt, though, crossing this Atlantic. And there's a poem in which I try to do that, recrossing it the other way to go to London. And, you know, she was literally free as soon as she stepped on that soil.
Yeah.
That said, she came back and still experienced slavery in the States, in Massachusetts, in Boston, in one of the seats of freedom. And she also experienced the American Revolution. It's right at her doorstep. And she, in fact, wrote about the affray, the Boston Massacre. And so I try to imagine, too, her thinking about Crispus Attucks, the famous black martyr in the Boston Massacre, who sort of helped jumpstart the revolution. Long story short, I really tried to get inside both her imagination in some way, but also sort of the American imagination. And what an amazing thing that she was in, as you said, this person enslaved, but also writing and also free and also not, and really sort of negotiating, you know, British patrons, which were many of the supports of her book, and also this new republic being made around her.
Is there a little piece of that poem that Sure. you wrote about her feelings as she was coming back basically to slavery from London?
Sure, I'll see if I can find something that. Docked among the fog and slight sun of London, you know who you are not, but that is little new. Native of nowhere, you'll stay a spell, return, write, grow still. I wake with you in my mind, leaning, learning to write. Your slight profile, that long pull of lower lip, its pout, proving you rescued by some sadness too large to name. My most excellence, my quill and ink lady, you scrawl such script no translation it needs. Your need is what's missing, unwritten wish to cross back, but not back, into that land for you of the dead. You want to see from above deck the sea, to pluck from wind a sense no land can give.
That's a portion of the poem that Kevin Young wrote about the African slave Phyllis Wheatley, who became the first published black poet in the United States. He also shared with us a moving poem he wrote about his father shortly after his father passed away.
Bereavement. Behind his house, my father's dogs sleep in kennels, beautiful, he built just for them. They do not bark. Do they know he is dead? They wag their tails and head. They beg and are fed. Their grief is colossal and forgetful. Each day they wake, seeking his voice, their names. By dusk, they seem to unremember everything. To them, even hunger is a game. For that, I envy. For that, I cannot bear to watch them pacing their cage. I try to remember. They love best confined space to feel safe. Each day, a saint comes by to feed the pair, and I draw closer the shades. I've begun to think of them as my father's other sons, as kin, brothers in paw. My eyes each day thaw. One day the water cuts off, then back on. They are outside dogs, which is to say healthy and victorious, purposeful, and one giant muscle, like the heart. Dad taught them not to bark. To point out their prey, to stay. Were they there that day? They call me like witnesses and will not say. I ask for their care and their carelessness. Wish of them forgiveness. I must give them away. I must find for them homes, sleep restless in his. All night I expect they pace as I do, each dog like an eye, roaming with the dead beneath an unlocked lid.
Kevin Young will step into his position as poetry editor at The New Yorker this fall. We're just about out of time for today's show, but before we leave you, I want to remind you that you can listen to us on your own schedule by subscribing to the Two Way Street podcast. And you'll find an archive of our shows at our website at gpb.org/TWS. Our senior producer is the unfailingly fabulous Jenny Ament. Our producer is the consummately clever Lisa Clark. And our engineer is the audacious audiophile Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. I'll see you again next week for another Two-Way Street.